I always wondered how it feels to sing at the Super Bowl halftime show, and I think I'm getting it now. Dear all, allow me to begin our panel on Russian foreign affairs, addressing many issues of Russia's involvement in other countries, including the U.S., internal affairs. I will be moderating this panel, and my name is Tatiana Mikhailova. I am senior instructor of Russian studies here, and I taught several courses on the topic here at CU, for instance, Russia Today and Spies in the Cold War and After, which probably prompted the organizers to invite me as a moderator. Or perhaps it was just my perfect English. We have an impressive arrangement of guest speakers today. All of them have first-hand experience with Russia, and I am honored to briefly introduce them to you. I'll start with Margot. Margot Squire is a career diplomat with over 30 years of service with the United States Information Agency and the United States Department of State. Margot served in Munich, Moscow, Melbourne, Baku, Ankara, and Washington, D.C. She has extensive experience in issues concerning the former Soviet Union and Russia, as well as public affairs, media relations, and international broadcasting. Next to me, Joe Silencione, who is president of Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation working to prevent the spread and use of nuclear weapons and to prevent conflicts that could lead to their use. Joe is an MSNBC nuclear security expert, analyst, and has worked on nuclear weapons policy in Washington for over 35 years. He is considered to be one of the top experts in the field.
I wrote that, of course.
And on the very, very left, we have Ambassador Ross Wilson. Ambassador Wilson is a seasoned diplomat with a 30-year career in the United States Foreign Service and has served as ambassador to Turkey and Azerbaijan. Currently, he serves as the interim ambassador to Georgia. Ambassador Ross Wilson is a distinguished senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and visiting lecturer in international affairs at George Washington University. Now I would like to outline the order in which we will proceed. First, I know that there will be an event starting at 4 with Amy Klobuchar in Mackey Auditorium. So if you are planning to leave us early, please just sit somewhere on the back so you will not create us, an anxiety for us, immediate anxiety. and our participants will have approximately 5 minutes to talk about today's topic. They will respond to each other's talks with their own questions and remarks. Afterwards, I will open the floor to questions from the public. And remember that you can send your questions through the CWA electronic portal or simply write them down and pass them through our producers. We'll get them. Questions from students will have a priority, and I encourage them to ponder questions on Russia that they have always wanted to ask, but for some reason were afraid to. And let's us begin. Having said everything, I'm giving the floor to Joe.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you for coming to this last panel for the World Affairs Council. It's been a great week, and I think I speak for all of us. It's a real pleasure to be here, and please invite us back. Thank you. Let me just set the stage in 5 minutes that we have here. I used to serve on the International Security Advisory Board for the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and then John Kerry. And we were doing a report for the Secretary on how to revive U.S. and Russian arms control measures. And we were maybe a quarter of the way through the preparation of that report when Russia invaded Ukraine. And it took us a while for us to understand that Russia was invading Ukraine. As Ross Wilson will explain, it was a new hybrid warfare. They were using little green men in military in uniforms that were not marked as Russian uniforms and aiding Ukrainian ultranationalists in this. So it took us a while. But that basically stopped our survey in the tracks. We had to start figuring out what we're going to recommend. And now that Russia had crossed this line, was doing something no other country in Europe had done since the end of World War II, that is, change the boundaries of Europe through military force, actually seize territory, Crimea in this case, and annex it. What was our response? And at first we said we have to stop business as usual. No more business with the Russians, drag everything to a halt. And then somebody said, well, what about the International Space Station? Right. Okay, we got to go there. Well, what about our cooperation in the Arctic? Right, where there's an circle of Arctic. Well, what about cooperation in negotiations with Iran, which were then under, right? And it turns out there are a whole lot of places where you need to engage Russia. You need to have Russia's involvement to solve some of the nettlesome global problems and that are in U.S. national security interest to do. But you couldn't let this kind of behavior go on, and yet it did. And then it's gotten worse. So we're still wrestling with what the proper response is to Russia. So let me give you a few of the hard indicators of Russia to put this in context. This is not the Soviet Union. This is not a global threat. This is not a nation that has a network of Communist parties that it controls. It is not an imminent threat to overthrow the United States or, for that matter, any other government, but it's got some troubling indicators that we can't ignore. It is a relatively small economy. By small, I mean it has an economy of about $1.5 trillion. It ranks 11th in the world in economy, so it ranks behind Canada and Italy and Brazil, so that gives you some scale of their relative economic power. It has a very low per capita income. It ranks 72 in the world in per capita income, a little better than Greece, but behind Hungary and Poland. So this is not an economic powerhouse. It's hard to think of any product that you buy from Russia or that the world buys from Russia, apart from natural resources, in particular oil and gas. And in fact, Europe gets 30% of its oil and natural gas from Russia, which gives Russia some leverage over European economies. The only measure of superpower status left to Russia is actually nuclear weapons. It has 6,490 nuclear weapons, just a little behind the United States, which has 6,550. So basically, we're equal. You know, at this level, it doesn't matter. We still have hundreds of times more than we need to blow up the world at this point, or dozens of times more than we need to blow up the world. But it is an existential threat to the United States. It could do this. It could launch its nuclear weapons at the United States and other countries and destroy us. Militarily, it is not a threat globally, but it is a threat locally. It's a threat to its neighbors. It's a threat to the border regions, as Ukraine demonstrates. And Putin has discovered a new tool which has allowed it to penetrate the Western democracies that he believes are threatening Russia. From Putin's point of view, the greatest threat to Russia is the U.S., European alliance, and NATO. So one of his strategic objectives is to break up that alliance, is to weaken that alliance. And one of the ways he's found to do this is by directly intervening in the internal affairs of Europe and the United States by aiding some of the far-right nationalist parties that are growing in Europe. So today, in the Washington Post, Anne Applebaum has an op-ed written, Russia is cultivating Germany's far right. And she details the economic assistance that the Russian oligarchs, through the Russian government, are providing the Russian far-right party. It's called Alternative for Germany. This is a neo-fascist party in Germany, and it compares to the kinds of parties that you're seeing on the rise, the Freedom Party in Italy, which has a share of state power. Italy's, or rather, the Nationalist League in Italy, and Austria's far-right party. Through Putin and through the government, and the Russian oligarchs have been financing Viktor Orban's activities in Hungary, another far-right nationalist, now leader of Hungary. And in this, and there, as you know, there appears to be ongoing ties to at least the Trump people around the Trump campaign, maybe in the Trump campaign, and still undisclosed economic relations with organizations such as the National Rifle Association here in the United States. So this use of Russia's oil riches, oil money, to fund disruptive political parties in the European nations is probably the greatest threat that Russia poses to us right now. And we do not have an answer for this. We do not have a coherent coherent U.S. response to either the rise of the far-right parties or Russia's aid for them. Let me stop there.
Good afternoon. I was going to start out by saying Russia today is not the Soviet Union and cannot be again. It's a struggling former great power. The economy is stressed. Demographics are again failing. Large demonstrations across the country this past year indicate that Putin's internal support is eroding. A recent Gallup poll found that 1 in 5 Russians would like to leave the country for good if they could, across all ages and educational background. So internationally, Russia is also an outlier state, surrounded by NATO and hostile states. As Joe pointed out, it has strong nuclear weapons. It's already pulling out of the INF agreement along with the United States and developing new nuclear weapons. This all gives me cause for concern because I think a wounded bear is the most dangerous. We were looking at whether Russia's following rules of sovereignty. And so I looked up movements of sovereignty because I'm a literal person. And there are two developments in terms of sovereignty. There is the development of a system of nation states after World War II. And then there was a reduction of sovereign nation states as the boundaries began to blur after World War II. Development of sovereignty up through 1600s with the Treaty of Westphalia, and then after World War II, there's this blending with European integration, growth and practices to promote human rights, some of the things that we, in fact, the United States, took advantage of after World War II with our radio broadcasts into the former Soviet Union, highlighting human rights practices and also trying to give them free access to international news. But what the Russians' hybrid actions clearly do not fit into this idea of sovereign nations. Even though they claim human rights for going into countries like Ukraine and the Baltics because they're supporting Russian nationals in these places. Russia seizing and annexing Crimea and fueling the war in the East is a direct challenge to the European order post-World War. The Carnegie Foundation said, and I want to quote this, Putin's Russia is casting a far broader net and effectively chipping away at the U.S.-led international order. Besides Ukraine, Syria, the U.S. elections, Russia is selling arms to undermine key U.S. alliances, like Turkey, exploiting Europe's divisions, embracing populist candidates, propping up the crisis-ridden Venezuelan government, stoking ethnic tensions in the Balkans, fueling high-level corruption in South Africa, and methodically spawning a worldwide propaganda network to challenge the Western order. And add to this the poisonings in the United Kingdom, first in 2004, Litvinenko with polonium, and then just recently in 2018, the Novichok virus against the Skripals, which, by the way, killed an innocent bystander and hospitalized some 30 people, manipulating elections, as we all know. And all of the work during our elections and the elections in other Western European countries to create disorder, heightened tensions and divisions within the United States. And then add to that cyber and attacking our energy grids and our commercial grids and even our routers and internet providers. In Georgia in 2008 and in Estonia in 2005, they brought down Russia brought down their internet systems, and in 2015 on Christmas Eve, the power grid in Ukraine was brought down on Christmas Eve. 230,000 Ukrainians without electricity in the middle of the winter. So, and we look at what happened in Atlanta, and we know that they had gotten into our grids. So all of these things are of concern. And we also know that, as I mentioned earlier, problems with his own country, Putin in the past has turned to external aggression as a way to shore up support within Russia. And right now, as the trend is also getting harder for him, and what we see of the Gallup poll, I think we need to be especially watchful. And we need to get our own house in order so that divisions can't be exploited. And we should also push back when Russia tries repressive actions against other countries. But we also need to work with Russia for the reasons that Joe mentioned. And I wanted to end with a quote from Winston Churchill. And he said this in 1944, "I cannot forecast to you the action of Russia. It is a riddle wrapped in a mystery, inside an enigma, but perhaps there is a key, and that key is Russian national interest." So people forget that last part about the national interest. And so we need to look for these key areas that our national interests overlap with theirs. And we can start to build a relationship, because it's going to take a lot of time and trust on both sides. And Russia does not trust us any more than we do them.
Well, thank you, and good afternoon to all of you. I want to say at the outset what I've tried to remember to say at every one of the panels. Joe already echoed this, how deeply honored I am. My wife and I are both to have been invited to this conference. It is such an interesting and eclectic mix of topics and people. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I congratulate and thank the organizers here for what they do. When I first started at the State Department in 1978, dates me a little bit, I certainly believed and assumed that a hostile Soviet Union that represented the principal threat to our way of life at that point, already for 30 years or so, was going to be a permanent feature of the world, or certainly permanent for my professional life. And so being involved in Moscow in the perestroika years and in Washington, working for Secretary of State Baker at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union, it was incredibly heartening to see that change. And there was a long decade plus, I think, of enthusiasm, Russia becoming a kind of a normal country, joining the civilized world. somehow, again, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, that sort of started to go a little bit off the rails, Russia becoming a dark and in a lot of ways deeply disruptive place. There's been a lot of discussion in many of the panels about disruption, and a lot of that disruption conversation tends to focus on the United States. And there's some reasons for that, and you all will have your own individual beliefs about that. Russia, a big time disruptor. And to sharpen some of the points that Joe and Margo made, what Russia does, the way it acts in the international system, fundamentally different from any other great power. Conquering the territory of neighboring states. You don't really do that. It really hadn't happened so much since World War II, and certainly not by great countries. Deliberate targeting in their military activities of hospitals, schools, civilian targets. In war, certainly aerial warfare, stuff happens. Targets get hit. In Syria, the Russians have been extraordinarily pinpoint precision targeting on civilian hospitals and schools and other targets. Likewise, targeting humanitarian workers in Syria, the so-called white Syrian white helmets who go into bombed-out facilities to try to fish people out. They get picked off by Russian, or attacked by Russian aircraft, picked off by Russian snipers or Russian-backed snipers. Or deliberately shooting down a civilian airplane.
Ah, yes.
Let's remember that, Malaysian Airways, carried out by either by Russian or by Russian-backed forces, and not at any time since has any Russian official apologized or even expressed one iota of regret. After the United States accidentally shot down an Iranian aircraft in 1988, the President of the United States immediately ordered an expression of regret by the State Department. We negotiated a deal with the Iranian government, the International Court of Justice, to take account of that. We recognized that what had happened had been a terrible mistake and tragedy, unlike what happened with Malaysian Airways. Or take assassinations. One of my colleagues here referred to the Skripal assassination, but then there's Litvinenko, the fellow who was the subject of polonium poisoning, Anna Politkovskaya, a Russian journalist in Russia, Galina Starovoyteva, another writer and member of parliament, Boris Nemtsov, a former prime minister of Russia, murdered by the Putin government. Is there another sort of serious country that does these things? I don't think so. And then there's the cyber piece. I think probably enough has been said on that. I presently have the honor of serving the United States in the Republic of Georgia, which has been a particular target of Russian activity, really going back to the breakup of the Soviet Union. But to bring it into relatively contemporary terms, in 2008, Russia provoked a war, used that as a pretext to carry out a massive bombing campaign more or less all over the country, and occupies to this day about 20% of the country's territory. It began its activity by working through local non-ethnic Georgian residents of the Republic of Georgia and other hired mercenaries from the North Caucasus countries on the other side of the Caucasus Mountains in southern Russia to subvert and undermine Georgia. That was the whole point of the exercise, to make ensure that Georgia was weak, that it was small, and could not really stand on its own 2 feet. It has largely repeated those tactics in Ukraine, working with disaffected pro-Russian elements, working with mercenaries, the so-called Little Green Men, if we remember them. It's actually called the Wagner Group. It's an organized paramilitary organization, illegal, including illegal under Russian law, that operates throughout Ukraine, operated in Syria, has operated in a large number of other places, including in the Central African Republic, in a number of Madagascar, Venezuela, Libya, Sudan, a variety of other places. Yes, I got the little red card. Just to close, how do we respond to this? We can come back to this in the discussion. This isn't 1939. As Margot pointed out, it isn't the Cold War. We're not on the verge of some terrible cataclysm. But those outlier behaviors are wrong. And if they're not stopped and dealt with in some fashion, they will continue. And there'll be more, and there will be more, and there will be more. And so effective measures are needed. I hope we have a chance to discuss some of those. Thank you for your attention.
I have a question to panelists, whether they would like to address each other's points.
Well, I'm particularly interested in hearing on the front lines of Georgia. I mean, this Georgia shares a border with Russia. This is, of all the countries, I would think that this is sort of the one that's most imminently threatened by these kinds of tactics. And do you see them developing? That is, the ones you described, the tactics of finding willing or sympathetic groups within the country, so within Georgia, and then working with them, maybe directly financing them, using social media to support their messages and counter the other messages, and then this, I guess in Georgia's case, the threat of military force to try to get the government to back down. I'd like to hear a little more about that. What it looks like on the front lines.
So the mechanisms of subversion to take the country apart are largely now in the past tense. Those things happened. Russia now occupies these territories. And it's a relatively stable front, so to speak. It's not an things happen, but it's not a kinetic zone, if we could call it that. But there is a lot of messaging that goes on from the Russians, Russian sources to Georgia. And I think the one that I would highlight here is consistent messaging to Georgian citizens that what the government there is aiming to do in developing democratic institutions, in developing a prosperous market economy, in developing close ties to Europe and to the West, to the United States, to the EU, to NATO, that none of this is going to go anywhere. That it will fail, that the country will be worse off as a result of that. And so what Georgians really need to do is make a strategic choice and cooperate with us. That's the message. Where the kinetic activities are still very much underway are in Ukraine, and there's a much more concerted ongoing effort there to undermine the government, weaken citizens' confidence in the government's ability to act, and the government, of course, government incapacity adds to that perception. It's not all Russia's creation, and then works through proxies in the Donbass, and of course in Crimea, which it fully occupies, to engage in violent activities that showcase to Ukrainian citizens that the Ukrainian military is not capable of supporting them, and that the West will not support Ukraine.
May I add? Thank you, Russ. That was wonderful. So besides actually sending in troops, one of the things that Russia has been really, really good at is exploiting the conflicts that are already going in the region. So, for example, the so-called frozen conflicts, Azerbaijan, Armenia. Russia has sold arms to both sides. By keeping this going, it serves Russia's interests because it keeps these states weak. Transnistria, the eastern border of Moldova is a crime, drug-ridden, terrible area that, no man's land, again, supported by Russia. The ironic thing is, though, if you look at Georgia and Ukraine and the countries that Russia is doing these things, these have all moved further towards the West. So it's not, to me, it's worked against Russia. Georgia is probably the most U.S. pro-U.S. country that I have ever been in. I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, they love Americans. They love our government. more than I do, I think. So, but I'm that's a joke. But still, seriously. So, to a certain extent, it's backfiring.
Thank you.
We don't.
What have got questions? Yeah.
All right. So I therefore will start these questions and answer session. And what I see lots of good questions coming from the public and students. And I will combine one of the students' questions together with mine. During the Cold War era, there was a power struggle between the United States and USSR, which was based on political, economic, and ideological differences. Russia doesn't believe in socialist or communist ideas any longer, and it is now more oriented towards capitalism than it has ever been in the 20th century. What are therefore the reasons for the conflict between Russia and the United States? And I will add from the student, what is the goal of Russia manipulative foreign policies? Power for power's sake? For power's sake?
Mm-hmm. Let me try. To me, the core of this is Putin maintaining his control over the country. So when the Soviet Union collapsed, there was this period where I think the West basically failed in helping Russia switch from a state-controlled economy to a free market economy. And I don't think we've kind of had a reckoning yet of how badly we failed and how bad our advice was and how basically we either ignored Russia or people went over to try to make a lot of money off of Russia. And the one area where there was success was global threat reduction, where we had a very robust and energetic program to help Russian nuclear scientists find alternative work, to help secure the nuclear materials in that country, to prevent them from theft or being smuggled through Moldova, which is one of the key, and Georgia, one of the key smuggling routes, where we actually have detected, you know, impoverished nuclear workers smuggling out weapons-grade uranium to sell in the black market. That was the one area of success, but in the process of this collapse, in the process of the 90s, a lot of Russians became very, very rich by sweetheart deals where they basically bought or acquired the state industries. So most of the state industries have gone now into private hands. Obviously, it's not a communist economy anymore. And you created this caste of oligarchs almost overnight. Within decades, people became billionaires, very rich. And perhaps the man who's richest of all is Vladimir Putin. There are people who, we don't know how much money Vladimir Putin has, but we believe he's the richest man in the world. Well, this was a former KGB agent who's now the richest man in the world. Well, how do you think he did that? You know, he didn't invent any software. He doesn't take a garage computer and turn it into the largest company in the world. No, they stole it. They basically stole the money from the Russian people. So now you have an oligarchic caste controlling this, and they want to maintain control. And they believe that the U.S. efforts of promoting democracy in Europe, in Russia, threaten that control. And guess what? They're right. They are correct. So it's not so much a military threat that Putin feels, it's a political threat to his control, and that's why, from his point of view, he's fighting back. So now he's going to meddle in Western elections the way he thinks we were meddling in his elections, by basically supporting the democratic movements that were arising in Eastern Europe, the so-called colored revolutions that spread to protests in Moscow. Take it away.
No, thank you very much. No, I agree exactly with what you said. I think there still is an ideological element, and this is particularly within Russia, which is an effort to look at the West and say, you know, Russia, do you want to be like that? Do you want these divisions? Do you want elections that are chaotic and divisive in, like, in the United States, or what Brexit is doing within the UK? So there's definitely, you know, a feeling of, you know, within the country of, you know, our system is working better than in the West. And I think a lot of people would agree with that.
I agree with the comments the others have made. I think additional factors are Putin aims to make Russia a great power on the world stage, and the activities he engages in, he believes, help to advance that. He wants to dominate the region right around Russia, the former Soviet states, and to the extent he can, areas immediately beyond that, and bring these countries back in, if not to reacquire them, at least to make them wholly owned subsidiaries of Russia, Russian policy. And then he aims to divide the West. Pure and simple.
Absolutely.
In his view, in this zero-sum game world that he lives in, that adds to Russian power and influence.
Thank you. I think Putin does have expansionist aims. He has said that the greatest tragedy of the 20th century, think about the 20th century for a minute, think about its tragedies.
Yeah, right.
The greatest tragedy of the 20th century was the breakup of the Soviet Union. And he basically believes, and this is this Russian nationalism. I mean, we talk about the European nationalist movements. The Russian nationalist movement is now is probably the most powerful nationalist movement in Europe. It's got state control, it has power, and it's expansionist, and it wants to reclaim the areas that it believes are truly Russian, as in Tsarist Russia.
And
tell me if we're getting anything wrong here, by the way.
I have a wonderful question from our students right away. They are listening and they are asking questions which pertain to our discussion. What are the similarities between the United States and Russia, Russia's foreign policy? How do Americans believe that these same strategies for influencing foreign countries in Russia are unacceptable but acceptable for us? Mm. That's
Let me try one. You know, one of my friends is Ken Wallach. He recently retired as the director of the... you love Ken Wallach, I'll tell him. He was the director of something called the National Democratic Institute. And this is one of the... To me, this is one of the things that makes America unique and such a hopeful nation. The Congress, in its wisdom, created the National Endowment for Democracy, and it created two arms in order to make sure we kept funding this. One was a Democratic arm, the National Democratic Institute, that worked with labor unions and the Democratic Party. And the other is the International Republican Institute that works with chambers of commerce and Republicans. Great. Everybody has an interest in keeping these things funded. The thing keeps funded. The NDI has got... operates in over 100 countries. It has thousands and thousands of workers, and one of the places they used to operate was in Russia, particularly in the 90s, where you're helping these people, you know, develop democratic norms. What does it mean to have a free union? What does that look like? You know, how does the population participate? What are the rules that should govern a free press? I mean, things that they never had. And we're helping them develop, and they do this in countries around the world. For Putin, that was a threat. That was subversion. He saw the work of NDI, and maybe this is as a threat, and so he thinks what he's doing is the same thing. He's going in with his agents and aiding parties in other countries and funding them in other countries. And he thinks this is equivalent. I don't think this is equivalent at all. I think one is actually, and I do not believe the NDI or the Republican Institute are subversive in any means. I think it's open, it's clear what we're doing, and that's a direct, it's just one instance, but it's a direct difference between the way America tries to promote its values in the world and the way Russia is promoting its operations in the world.
That's right. I just wanted to add on to that. In fact, one of the things that the I think the Mueller report found was that the Russians were actually hacking into. It was kind of a bipartisan thing. So they were hacking Democratic institutions and Republican institutions. And they were infiltrating through this sort of gray area of lobbying to get into, you know, organizations that were close to the Republican Party without telling them they were doing this. And this is a very big difference between what the U.S. government was doing or the Soros Foundation was doing in Russia openly versus the subversive, you know, pretending that you were working, you were an independent organization working to support the NRA or whatever organization you want to choose.
Okay. I mean, on the flip side, You know, there is a dark and cynical side to U.S. foreign policy, where we have invaded countries, where we have assassinated leaders. So when you ask who does this, conducts assassinations, we do. And we've done it, where we've killed the leaders of foreign countries or rebels in other countries. So there are some equivalents. It's not black and white. It's not good and bad. There are many, many things that the U.S. has done in its history, starting from before there was an America, that are actually similar to some of the techniques that the Russians use today.
There is a difference.
Go.
We account for what we do.
I don't know, man. The Pentagon Papers, I mean, you know, we had to smuggle those things out to find out the true history of U.S. involvement in Vietnam.
And they got out, didn't they?
Oh,
and it was
okay,
the court
so if you
system.
Mean, it, go ahead. Work, you mean so the system as a whole works,
yeah.
If not necessarily the government?
Individual cases, maybe.
Okay.
So it was a question, you know, to answer.
We could take another half hour on this.
There is another one from the student, and it's a little bit, you know, losing its language, but I hope that it's a bulb joke kind of things. How many Russians does it take to screw up American relations? elections. More seriously, even if all allegations about Russian meddling through Facebook and other social media are correct, in your opinion, could they really affect the 2016 election? Will they affect the 2020 election?
There was an excellent report put out last year by the Democratic minority on the Senate Intelligence Committee. It's really first rate, and it's the kind of thing. It's one of those other things that restores your faith in government, that you can have this kind of analysis and this kind of series of recommendations. It's a thick report about what we know about Russian interference and how to counter it. Unfortunately, it was issued by the minority, and they have no power to do this. So the U.S. government does not yet have a response to the Russian meddling, in part because the U.S. government does not recognize that meddling actually occurred. Every other day the President of the United States will say that maybe it occurred. But there's been no coherent response to it. So yes, I would be worried about the 2020 elections. And it's not so much that I think that they can hack into our voting machines, although I wouldn't rule it out. There's been no evidence that they're actually able to do that. It's using the same techniques they used before, which I think are still going to be effective because we haven't developed a plan to counter it.
Right. And you mentioned 2016. So 2018, it's clear that the Russians at least tried to interfere with the elections, and that our cyber force has actually put out, there have been articles that point out how they stopped hacks and how they actually countered them, like going back to the Internet Research Agency and others whose computers were stopped. And so there are reports from within the Russian, you know, organizations when they're saying, my computer is down. You know, I don't understand what's going on, because they're sending messages to their friends saying, I don't know what's happening. I can't send any emails. And these have come out so that they tried it in 2018. They'll try it again in 2020. No question.
And maybe to broaden the issue a little bit, what some of the experts who look at Russia's disinformation efforts write about is a comprehensive whole of government and media, all those words put together with hyphens, whole of government and media approach to getting out poisonous and disruptive narratives into the public debate here, using statements by Russian leaders, by Russian diplomats, messages disseminated by Russian intelligence agencies, purported validators in the social media who validate the stuff that's there and help to spur it along, troll farms, Sputnik and RT television that broadcasts now in the United States. And these, at first blush, these things look like they're all just, you know, spontaneously going on. They're not spontaneously going on. They're carefully orchestrated and choreographed. They can be taken apart, and there are experts that are taking these things apart. The Atlantic Council, with which I'm affiliated, has done a lot of work on this in, I think they call it the Information Defense Center of the Council, trying to take these things apart. It can be done, mm-hmm. and it can be addressed, but it's important that people recognize that it is happening. This whole of government strategy to attack Western institutions and values in our space, in America and in Europe.
And just real quick, we have to pay more attention to what's going on in Europe because this is the front lines. This is where it's happening in sort of real time, and pay attention to it. And there are signs of hope. I mean, in Slovakia, Susana Kaputova was just elected a female president of Slovakia. She's a pro-European, sort of human rights elected. In an election that where the Russians were also trying to interfere, and it didn't work. Mm-hmm. You know, there was enough counter effort and both enough public awareness to do it. So this is not an invincible force. You can counter it, and there are ways to counter it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I have a question from one of the students who starts with, as Joe mentioned. So it's already...
Cue it up for me.
Right. Russian interference in, as Joe mentioned, Russian interference in Western countries has been without a response from the United States. In your eyes, what should our response be?
Yeah, well, Google's Democratic Minority Report, Senate Intelligence Committee on Russian interference, and it lays it out in exhausting detail. And part of it just starts with public acknowledgement and that this is happening, that it is a real threat, that they did intervene, and they intervened on one side. Yes, they hacked both computers. Yes, they got information from the Republican National Committee and the Democratic National Committee. They released the information they got from the Democrats and didn't for the Republicans. So they clearly decided, whether that was their original intent or not, that they wanted to favor Trump's campaign here.
Responses.
Yes.
Do you want me to add?
Go, please do.
Okay, sanctions. You know, we are responding. Maybe not always, and maybe not hard enough, but I was looking at some statistics, and and according to some research, by the end of 2017, Russia's gross domestic product was almost 2% lower than it would have been without sanctions. And according to Bloomberg, Russia's economic gain in the past 5 years was 10% less than what would have been expected. 6% of this is due to the sanctions.
Yeah.
So sanctions do bite.
Right.
They are making a difference.
The U.S. did sanction the firms and officials that are connected to these cyber attacks on the nuclear reactors that occurred last year.
So the Little Green Men, the Wagner group, sanctioned. Its commander sanctioned. The organization has been sanctioned. To come back to what do we do about it, to add to what the others have said, sunshine.
Mm-hmm.
Shining a light on these activities that are objectionable and that are wrong and they're not supposed to be acceptable in the international arena. Take apart the propaganda, the point that I made earlier. Find ways to counter it. You know, during the Cold War, we spent hundreds of millions, probably, on the Voice of America and Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Those strategies aren't necessarily the ones that work now, but there surely are ways that we similarly can counter Russian propaganda, and including countering it in Russia, and we should be doing so.
Thank you. And I'm combining two questions from the students. What degree of United States-Russian cooperation can we expect so long as Putin is in power? What can we expect from a post-Putin Russia? And what can we expect to see with Putin's departure? You can see that, these are similar questions.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, this is such an interesting dynamic, because even while U.S.-Russian relations came almost to a halt over the invasion of Ukraine, in Geneva and Vienna, Russia was still cooperating in the negotiation of the Iran anti-nuclear agreement.
Right.
We were able to sort of compartmentalize this, and the Russians were full partners in this. They weren't playing a duplicative game. So you can, and of course we still cooperate with the Russians on things like the International Space Station. This is how our astronauts get to the International Space Station, which Russian launchers. So some level of cooperation continues to go on. If you mean sort of on the big sort of geostrategic scale. You know, this is one of the ironies. One of the bright spots of Trump's election as president was the possibility that he could negotiate a new arms control agreement with Russia to cut the massive overkill capability. Both countries still have in nuclear weapons. But because of the clear complications of Russian interference in the election, Trump has been unable to do that. Any sort of grand cooperation with Putin would become immediately suspect. So on the big problems of Europe, of arms control, of I don't see any prospects for cooperation. Do you?
Yeah. No. I would add that even after the so-called demise of the reset, you know, we had negotiations on New START.
Yes.
We also had, you know, huge missile and warhead reductions. We had negotiations and cooperation on against the Democratic Republic of North Korea.
Yeah, but that was pre-Ukraine, pre-interference in the elections.
No,
how about now?
It continues. I'm not sure now. That's another question. We've had limited cooperation on countering terrorism. I mean, we've each kind of notified each other of some terrorist threats. That's been in the press. Very limited.
Right.
And I agree that it's really hard right now because of the situation both in the U.S. and also in Russia.
I would just add, I think a little bit more confrontation is probably in order.
A little more what is it?
Confrontation.
Yeah.
On our side against them.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there is an interesting question. Can we use Putin's methods to undermine and disrupt Russia? Putin's hold on power, why would that be wrong?
No, why don't you go, Ross? I would be strongly against any overt or covert U.S. interference in Russia's internal political activities. I think that is hugely counterproductive and would not work.
I don't disagree. I think that there are several things that we can do, however. Russia is, as Margot particularly noted, a small, weak country beset with some very serious economic, social, demographic, and other problems. It's vulnerable. And one of the things you do in international affairs, if there are things you don't like, you work on other countries' vulnerabilities. So Russia depends immensely on oil and gas as its revenue. I don't know what the percentage is, but if it's 80%, I would believe it. 80% of the budget coming from the oil and gas extraction industries and sales to principally to Europe. Okay, so to the extent that we can persuade European governments and consumers of energy to use other sources to develop their own, maybe green energy resources or other sources of supply, including from the United States, and that reduces Russian income, that's a good thing. To the extent that we can stimulate greater production in energy globally that drives down the cost of oil and gas, that hurts Russia very serious ways. Russia, hugely reliant now on the international financial system. That's why sanctions really bite them, because they they have problems doing transactions in dollars. Mm-hmm. That's a road, I think, to continue to go down to exploit Russia's vulnerabilities. We would want to be very careful and circumspect about overtly or covertly interfering in Russia's internal politics, but it is a fact that young Russians love the fact that their country is no longer as isolated as it was in the Cold War. They're all connected with the internet. They know what's going on. They can travel freely, and they want that to continue. And the policies that Putin promotes that run counter to this are not popular. The recent internet bill that's reported in the papers today or yesterday to control the internet, that ain't popular with Russian young people. That's a vulnerability, and I think a problematic one. A significant source of indirect source of Russian influence is its relationship with China. Various people in the room may have positive or negative recollections of President Nixon and Secretary of State Kissinger, but one of the things they did that was highly successful was to find ways to drive a wedge between and take advantage of the differences between Russia and China in ways that helped the United States and helped promote our security issues. So I think there's a basket of things, avenues that we can pursue that add to Putin's problems and directly or indirectly help to promote change in that country. And those are the kinds of things we should be aiming to do.
And let me I would just go. Add, do you want, should I? And I would just add that in 2011 and 2012, the beginning of 2012, there were these huge demonstrations in Moscow of 100,000 people. Russians took to the streets because they weren't happy that Putin was going to, you know, continue to be president. And at that point, if you remember, President Putin blamed this on Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
And also for supporting and driving these elections. Or these demonstrations, and it also it led to a huge crackdown within Russia against journalists, against civil society, you know, branding those who didn't support traitors, fifth column, all of these things. So I would hesitate to say that we should get involved. Yes, Russia. It would be wonderful if Russians themselves spontaneously did, but we should not be in there fueling it.
Let me just add two more things. One is my friend Sam Nunn, who runs a sister organization called the Nuclear Threat Initiative. His big issue right now is Congressional Duma consultations. The Duma is the Russia's parliament, and he thinks that we should be promoting dialogue and exchanges and visits between members of the U.S. Congress and members of the Duma, and I agree. Putin is not going to last forever. There is going to be successors to Putin. Who are they going to be? What is their understanding of America going to be? It's quite likely they will come, possible they come from the Duma, and we should be building those bridges, and I would add we should also be doing that in non-government ways. And it's, people-to-people exchanges. I was invited to a conference on arms control in Moscow this week. I like Boulder better, so I came here. but I'm looking forward to another invitation and to have those kinds of exchanges.
Well, and I would add that we have had in the past huge people-to-people exchanges or people-to-people exchanges, and the Russian government has seen them as being, creating revolutionaries or revolutionary sentiments within Russia. So they kicked out the Peace Corps. They stopped a very successful high school exchange that brought people from across the former Soviet Union to the United States, living for a year in American homes. Russia pulled out of that a few years ago because of this, trying to keep the virus of the West away. So yes, any ways that we can find of building those ties are really important.
And I have, I'm sorry that I stopped applause, I think. I have a question. I think that Ambassador Wilson will be answering because we have just 2 minutes left. Do you have concerns about Russia as to goals in respect to Baltic states, in particular Latvia?
Well, I think I'll broaden the answer just a teeny bit. I think as American policymakers look out at Russia's actions in the region, the next place that people seem to be particularly concerned about is Belarus, another one of the former Soviet republics, ruled by a rather tyrannical, erratic leader, but proudly independent and not interested in being dominated out of Moscow. The Russians, I believe, late last year more or less demanded to be able to establish a military base in the western part of Belarus, which gets pretty close to the Polish border. It's part of a strategy, presumably, to counter increased deployments of rotational deployments of NATO forces in Poland and elsewhere in Eastern Europe. Theoretically, at least, the same kind of pressure tactics could, I suppose, be used in the Baltics. The difference, and in Latvia, the difference, of course, is those countries are members of NATO. And insofar as NATO remains a strong, well-led, well-equipped force, I think that's unlikely. Putin isn't crazy, and I think would be very careful to take on a threat that he can't deal with. But to the extent that Putin sees that NATO is weak, that it's divided, and that an action in the Baltics might help to further weaken and divide NATO, if not destroy it altogether, he might be tempted, and that's one of the reasons why I think all of us, and that has come out in other sessions of this conference, very preoccupied with American foreign policy, with America's international alliance relationships, America's leadership of the West as remaining essential for peace and security in Europe and in the world.
Yes. And we have more questions remaining, but let's save them, for the future and the next conference of World Affairs, because, as you see, the topic is endlessly interesting and entertaining. So I would like to you to join me in thanking our wonderful guests and participants for their input. Thank you.
Thank you
so much.